You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the federal government rejected the Dakota Access Pipeline route. We'll find out why some activists still aren't ready to celebrate.
First, if you've ever gotten stuck on a negative emotion for hours or days or longer, or if you do your best to completely ignore those negative emotions, our next guest says you're not doing yourself any favors.
She says our emotions, positive and negative, can give us a lot of useful information about where we are in life and help us in our relationships and our careers, but only if we know how to read them.
The key is something she calls emotional agility. And the good news, she says, we can learn it and we can practice it.
Susan David joins us now. She's a psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School, and her new book is called Emotional Agility: Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. Susan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with your term, emotional agility. What is it?
So how we navigate our inner thoughts, our emotions, and the stories that we tell ourselves drive everything in our lives. How we parent, what jobs we apply for, how we live, our relationships, and so on. And emotional agility is effectively the ability to be with those thoughts, emotions, and stories in a way that allows us to notice them, to derive use from them, but also to not let them sabotage our ability to act in ways that are congruent with our goals and our values.
Let's talk about the opposite and the problem that we're solving here, the idea of emotional rigidity. What does that look like? What's going on in our minds when we're not emotionally agile?
So often people drive their behaviors with effectively their thoughts and emotions. So we get hooked into ways of being. For example, we might feel that we are being undermined in a meeting and therefore automatically shut down. Or our spouse says something and we walk out of the room. So emotional inagility is when our thoughts, our emotions, and our stories effectively call the shots, as opposed to other ways of being and acting that are more values congruent and more connected with how we truly want to be in the world.
It seems like there's a lot of emphasis in our culture today on the positive, on focusing almost exclusively on the positive. And sometimes there's that other aspect. If you focus on the positive, you attract the positive. And so as a result, it seems like sometimes we're not really supposed to acknowledge the negative stuff. What do you think about that?
So I think that this narrative in our culture is not serving us. I don't think it's serving our resilience. I don't think it's serving our well-being. If we look at, for example, that by 2030, the World Health Organization predicts that depression, not heart disease, not diabetes, not cancer, depression will be the leading cause of disability globally, it is frightening. And this narrative, I believe, around let's just be happy, we can all choose our happiness, let's be positive all the time, I think that in many ways that actually undercuts our ability to be resilient. And I'll give you an example. We know that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. Things might be going well today, but we might be and are very likely in our lives to be beset by illness or job loss or things that are difficult. And unless we are able to actually be skilled at understanding, labeling, dealing with these negative experiences in a way that is true and real and that actually helps us, we're not likely to be effective. So there's a growing body of research, for example, showing that people who overly focus on trying to be happy and think positive actually over time become less happy. A friend of mine who recently died of stage 4 breast cancer said that for her, it felt like the tyranny of positivity, that she was ill and dying, and everyone around her kept on saying, just be positive, just be positive. And she said to me, you know, if it was just a case of being positive, the friends in my stage 4 breast cancer support group would be alive today. And by keeping on getting this messaging that I've just got to be positive, what it starts to do is it starts to almost blame me for my own death. So for many reasons, I think that this emphasis on being positive and being happy don't serve us and are just not true to the reality, which is that our so-called negative emotions are core to our evolutionary way of being in the world, and we need to learn how to be effective with them.
We're talking to Susan David. Her new book is called Emotional Agility. And you write, Susan, that we're not just born with or without emotional agility. We can learn it. We can train in it. And you kind of lay out steps to figuring out our emotions, building a better relationship with them. Step one, you say, is showing up. What do you mean by that?
So often when people are experiencing difficulties, they do one of two things. The first is bottling. Bottling is where people push emotions aside. They'll say something like, I'm unhappy in my job, this relationship isn't going well, but at least I've got a job or a relationship, so I'm just not going to think about it. On the other hand, we can often do what looks like the opposite, which is to brood. And brooding is where we get so immersed in our difficult experiences. Why am I feeling what I'm feeling? This is terrible. This is awful. That we struggle to move forward. Now, what's fascinating is that even though bottling and brooding look so different, both of them are associated with lower levels of well-being, higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety over time. So one of the first things that I talk about in emotional agility is that even though there is this cultural narrative around being positive and being happy, that it's really important to show up to our difficult experiences by not trying to jostle with them, not trying to argue with whether we should or shouldn't have them, I should be happy, I shouldn't be happier, but to rather end any struggle that we have internally by dropping the rope, to notice our thoughts and emotions with compassion and curiosity and see what surfaces for us.
So if I'm having a negative emotion, you say I should just acknowledge that, you know, I'm having this negative emotion and I'm going to see what it's all about.
Yeah, I mean, difficult emotions, our emotions are data. Our emotions, even the more difficult emotions, have evolved to help us to survive as a species and to shape our behavior. And so while our so-called negative emotions are not directions, they are still data. They are data, not directions. And so often beneath our difficult emotions are signs to things that we care about. I've never met someone with depression who isn't at some level concerned about how do I better be in the world? Someone who is maybe a guilty parent who isn't at some level concerned about presence and connectedness with their children, or whose idea has been stolen at work, who isn't concerned about issues of equity and fairness. So often beneath our difficult emotions are signs to things that we value. And if we can pay attention to those data, not directions, we start being able to surface things that are truly meaningful and important and to use that information in critical ways in our lives.
So once we identify those emotions, that kind of takes us to our next step, which you call stepping out. And you reference a point that we are not Mr. Spock from Star Trek with a completely dispassionate view, but we can kind of try to be and say, why? What is this emotion? What does it mean? How do we kind of step outside our emotions and analyze, as you say, what information they're trying to give us?
So absolutely. You know, so often when we are hooked, when we are emotionally inagile, we are being driven by our emotions and thoughts. And so stepping out is really this capability that we all have to really discern, you know, who's in charge here, the thinker or the thought? Who's in charge, the emotion, the fear that's telling me to not apply for a job or to shut down or to be angry, or me, the person who is big enough to experience all of my emotions? And all of your listeners will have had this experience of, say, being really angry with a customer service agent and wanting to yell down the telephone, and simultaneously having that ability to helicopter above their thoughts and emotions and saying to themselves, I feel really angry, but yelling is going to get me nowhere. So there are key ways, and in emotional agility, I describe some of these as to how we can develop the skill set. I can give two quick examples.
Sure.
The first is that so often when we experience difficult emotions, we might use very broad brushstrokes to describe how we're feeling. So we'll come home from work and we'll say, oh, I was stressed today. I was stressed. And the next day, how was your day? I was stressed. There is a very big difference between being stressed versus disappointed, stressed versus angry, stressed versus I thought I would be in a different place in my career or in my life. And what we know from the research is that people who say to themselves, what are two other options? What are two other things that I might be experiencing here? Become more able to really look at and be effective with their emotions. And we know that when people are more nuanced, not using these very broad brushstrokes, that it enables them to have, again, better levels of psychological health, but it also activates what is called the readiness potential in our brains. If I know that the real reason I'm stressed is because I thought that I'd be in a different place in my career, what it starts to do is it starts to actually shape our capacity to set goals in that area. So that's the first way that we can start to step out. A very quick second way is that so often when we are angry, we say to ourselves, I am angry, I am stressed, I am anxious. And what we're doing when we do that is we are effectively identifying 100% of who we are with that emotion. I'm angry, I'm stressed. And a very simple strategy, which all of your listeners can use, is to simply notice the thought or feeling for what it is. I'm noticing the thought that I'm being undermined. I'm noticing the feeling that I'm angry. Now, it sounds really simplistic, but what that starts to do is it starts to create space between you and the action that you take, this very critical pause that we as human beings need to be able to cultivate.
We're talking to Susan David. Her new book is Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about emotional agility and how we can build it in ourselves? Do you feel like you've been guided by your emotions for better or worse? Do you feel like you've gotten better at understanding your own emotions over the years? What did you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're talking about emotional agility with Susan David. She says we can learn a lot from our emotions and use them as signposts in our lives instead of getting locked into long-term negative emotions.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. Have you gotten hooked into negative messages about yourself? Have you broken out of that? Do you bottle up emotions or brood over them? Do you have questions about how emotional agility works? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller right now. We've got Joe joining us in Watertown. Joe, hi.
Hi. I just came to a new thought when I was listening. The guest mentioned the nuanced thought and how that connects to our the theory on the brain. I forget the terms you mentioned, readiness, I think, for the brain. Now, I wonder if the guest has ever looked at or is interested in looking into what we discussed a lot here about politics and how people get worked up emotionally over the so-called fake news and other news sites that have spread a lot of stuff that gets people angry and very emotional. And I found that interesting when you mentioned the word nuanced, because we always think of nuanced thought versus some of the quite non-nuanced thought that you see people is when they espouse a quick thing they see online, and it's a generalization, maybe something like, you know, all these illegals are taking our jobs or something like that, and they walk around with a simple thought process and an anger behind that, and that the nuanced thought is not there. And that could be partly why people that properly vet and then do the research and are more educated are not getting this emotion, because they're putting it into proper proportion.
Joe, thanks for that comment. Appreciate it. And Susan, he's kind of getting there at sort of seeing things as black and white or binary. You're mad or you're not mad. Things are going well or they're not. And you're tying into politics there. But is there something to the complexity of emotions and being able to see them in different ways?
Absolutely. I think that was just a brilliant question. And it is something that I talk about in emotional agility, how as human beings, we are so often drawn to what in psychological terms is called premature cognitive commitment. The idea that we very quickly want to put ourselves and other people in categories. So sometimes we do this in ways that don't really impact us. You know, I don't eat from mezes in Turkey. We create a little story about ourselves and it becomes comforting. But of course, we see this in more pernicious ways when it comes to quickly putting people into boxes, stereotypes, categorizations, and so on. And we know absolutely that one of the ways that we become more effective as human beings is to start trying to dig out a little bit more. So to move away from this idea that I am just the first thing that I think and to really open our hearts and our minds up to being more curious. One of the things that I actually talk about in the book, and I think it relates absolutely to this question as well, and it's fairly frightening, is how us as human beings, how we are comforted by narratives that we hear time and time again. And so what happens is when there is a narrative, even if that narrative is fake, even if that narrative doesn't serve us, when we hear something time and time again, our brains start to see that narrative as being, therefore it is truthful, and therefore it's something that I should act on. And so in emotional agility, I talk about how people get even sucked into comforting relationships that don't serve them or comforting jobs that they've been in for years and years and years but that are going nowhere. So yes, we absolutely construct these narratives. We are often bound by them, and the only way we can start becoming more effective is when we start recognizing them for what they are and start trying to surface our values. How do I really want to be in the world? How do I want to come across? Is this narrative something that is congruent with the way I truly want to live my life?
Talking to Susan David about her new book, Emotional Agility. Back to our callers now with Aiden in Green Bay. Aiden, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to tell us about, Aiden?
I wanted to just personally leave a comment as far as my personal experiences go. I'm actually just turned 19 years old. Started my freshman year of college, and I've been in therapy for 6 or 7 years for a lot of just rough stuff at home. And one of the things, we didn't call it emotional agility, we called it like resiliency, but, you know, being able to intelligently handle your emotions, I feel like has changed my life significantly. I mean, to a point where I feel like overall I'm a much better person. In fact, I just found out today that my dog is, the ACL tear that we thought she had is actually an advanced form of cancer, and so that has to be my finals week. So, you know, being able to handle that appropriately, I think, is just, you know, a skill that just, I think, I wish it was taught more in school, you know, along the way, because it's so completely invaluable.
Aiden, thanks for sharing that. I'm glad you're feeling like you're dealing better with emotions. Sorry about your dog. Good luck with that, and good luck with finals week. But Aiden saying, Susan, this is a skill, and it's made a big difference for him in dealing with these, in learning these emotional skills.
Yeah, these are critical skills. I mean, these skills drive every single aspect of our lives. And I, firstly, you know, congratulate Aiden for the grace and courage and dignity that it takes to, you know, recognize that you maybe aren't dealing with something as effectively and to start to cultivate some of the capacity in this area, because so much of it is learnable. The other thing that I just wanted to say in relation to his comment about it being taught, I could not agree more. When we start seeing the rates of depression, anxiety, and difficulty and how these are growing exponentially in young children and in young adults, It's frightening. I recently wrote an article, or was interviewed for an article in the New York Times called Teaching Your Child Emotional Agility. And in it, what I speak about is how so often as parents, we want to, you know, protect our children from difficulties. And we'll run in and try to save them from difficulties, what I call emotional helicoptering. And yet the only way as children we can start to develop skills around emotions is by being allowed to experience difficulty, by being encouraged to label our emotions, by being encouraged to think about our values and what's important to us, and by being encouraged to shape our behaviors and choose actions. One, you know, very beautiful quotation that's been attributed to Viktor Frankl and that I talk about in emotional agility, especially in the context of raising children, is this idea that between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space lies our power to choose. And it's in that choice that comes our growth and freedom. And so often in everyday life, at work, at home, from when we're younger to when we're older, we respond on autopilot. And emotional agility is effectively this ability to be compassionate and kind with ourselves, but to also recognize that our emotions don't need to call the shots, to create that space, to be able to create that learning and growth. This is critical.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
I am so grateful to be here. So thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Susan David, psychologist on the faculty of Harvard Medical School and the author of the new book, Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. And we have a link to her Emotional Agility quiz over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Didn't have a chance yet to go and take the quiz. I think I'll do it. And when you go to find that link, tell us if you have a story, if you were raised or brought up your kids to try to deal with their emotions in the way our guest is talking about. If you've made a change in your life along those lines, if you want to share, you can even tell us how you did on the quiz. I don't know if it's graded A, B, C, or what, but let us know. Has your job ever felt and sounded like this?
I'm going to need you to go ahead and come in tomorrow. So if you could be here around 9, that would be great. Okay. Oh, and I almost forgot. I'm also going to need you to go ahead and come in on Sunday, too. Okay?
A moment there from the movie Office Space, a comedy about the indignities of work that may hit close to home for a lot of people. Unpredictable schedules, no respect from bosses or the public, being treated as a cog in the machine, not as a person. It's a topic that's briefly come up a couple times lately here on Central Time, so now we're going to devote this conversation to the idea of the dignity of labor, whether it exists, which jobs have it, how to create more of it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had a job where you felt like, yeah, you are being treated with respect and dignity, or a job where you were not? What makes the difference for you? Is it the pay and the benefits, or something less tangible? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom Thibodeau joins us now. He's a distinguished professor of servant leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, where he's been for 30 years. He also founded the nation's only master's program in servant leadership. Tom, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rob, for having me.
Well, Tom, this topic of workplace dignity came up in a conversation you and I had about servant leadership a while back. It's part of what set me to thinking about this conversation now. What does servant leadership have to teach us about dignity and respect for people in their working lives?
Well, that everyone's work has dignity. Everyone's service is important to the whole and the common good. We have different levels of responsibility, different levels of compensation, but everyone contributes to a greater good by the work that they do each and every day. We spend 66% of our adult lives at work, and now electronically, because we are asked to stay in contact with our workplaces almost continuously, we might even spend more time than that at work, and yet we've very seldom have a serious conversation about the nature of work and the place that it holds in our lives.
Why don't we talk about that more?
Well, I'm not sure. You go back and you look in the French word for work is travail, which means pain. The German word for work is Arbeit, which means hardship. The Spanish word for work is the same word as they use for torture. So I think that for a long time, many people, when they talked about their work, it was very painful. It was hard, very disciplined, dangerous work. Only until the last century have we had much more safety in the workplace. But people worked hard and at risk to their own health. The Romans and the Greeks didn't even have a word for work. They called it ascola, those people without leisure. And so you think about the number of people who feel like they work almost all the time. They work a full-time job, and then they go home and spend another 2 or 3 hours working at home. So work is an essential part of our life, and yet very seldom do we end up talking about it. You watch TV, and where is it that you see people actually working? It's crime investigation. It's in a court of law. It's police work. Many shows, let's say Seinfeld, everybody spent their whole adult lives at a coffee shop or Friends. And you look at these different sitcoms, and where does anybody actually sit down and are engaged in hard work?
Well, and a part of why I'm interested in this now is the changing nature of jobs. Less and less, a smaller proportion of us over time are involved in making stuff, whether that's growing foodstuffs or manufacturing things. More and more of our jobs, we're hearing, city, rural, you name it, are in service types of jobs. And that might be at a retail counter. It might be in a healthcare sitting, things like that. Are those jobs in particular ones we're trying to sort out how to respect the people and respect the dignity of the jobs they're doing?
Well, I think today, Rob, if we spend time, reflecting back, yesterday a number of us would have parents that are being taken care of by somebody in a nursing home. People who gave up time with their own families in order to care for our loved ones. And the same thing could be said about police officers, firefighters, all those people that were working in airports yesterday, people that were ready to go out and protect us on the roads. And so it's amazing to me that our life is really based and predicated on the service of other people in very, very many ways that we take them for granted. And I think that one of the things that we can do is appreciate the people that we come in contact with who are serving us so well.
Talking to Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo University in La Crosse. He's a professor of servant leadership there. We're talking about dignity and respect for people in the jobs that they do and whether we have it. We have that kind of dignity and respect. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We've gone through changes in our societies like this before. I'm thinking the Industrial Revolution, people who used to be artisans and make things by hand watched their careers go away while these assembly lines came up, seen as dehumanizing. But then there was a sort of dignity of labor as the union movement rose. Can we learn lessons from how we've been through big changes in the past?
Well, definitely we can. What happened with the Industrial Revolution, it was rather interesting that Henry Ford had a very difficult time hiring people to work on the assembly line because they found it so tedious and did not engage them. And so what he had to do is raise wages in order to keep a force on hand, a workforce. But then what happened is that people got paid for what they did and not so much in terms of what they created or what they thought about. And I think that what's happening now, what we're finding, is that employers are engaging their employees not only in terms of what is it that they do, but engaging in terms of their ideas, what is it that they think, and even going now to looking in terms of who is it that they are as a person, paying attention to their being. The way in which that they can raise and lift their spirits. Finding out that when people are exhausted, that they can't give you their best work. So what are we doing in the workplace to help to renew them?
One thing I think about as we see a shift from manufacturing to servant jobs, this is highlighted a lot in this election, is you've got a group of people in this country who used to be able to support a family with, say, that factory job that people talk about going away. If there's a job available to them now, it might be more of a service type job that doesn't pay enough. How important is the actual compensation, the pay and the benefits as part of seeing your job as one that has dignity?
Barbara Ehrenreich wrote an amazing book that we're still reading and studying called Nickel and Dimed, in which she went to work for places in terms of the service industry and met these incredible people who were working hard and long hours, sometimes even going without meals themselves. And I got this quote that I think is disturbing, but it goes right to the heart of your question. When someone works for less pay than she can live on, when, for example, she goes hungry so that you can eat more cheaply and conveniently, then she has made a great sacrifice for you. She has made a gift of her abilities, her health, her life. The working poor are the major philanthropists of our society. And you begin to recognize that many people do sacrifice on behalf of all of us, and that we do need to have questions about the dignity of work and the justice of a fair wage.
Tom, we've got a full phone line, so I want to start bringing in callers now. Amy is with us in Watertown. Amy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Amy?
Well, talking about dignity in the workplace, I have been a waitress, or as I would rather call myself, a server, for 31 years. And the dignity, servers don't get as much dignity as they should. I had made a response to who had answered the phone as one perfect example is working at a diner that I had worked at. I was 9 months pregnant. And it was a very, very busy Sunday morning. And the gentleman and his family that I was waiting on, he didn't get his food as fast as he liked. And he stood up to leave. And in the process, he grabbed a handful of pennies and threw them right into my face.
Wow. And do you, Amy, do you see that from customers? Do you see it from bosses, too, on these jobs?
I see it more from customers, but I have had a level of that from bosses, from my employers, who just don't understand. They're not doing the job. Their job is, you know, generally behind the scenes, so they don't know what actually goes on. And when you do bring it to their attention, it doesn't seem like it. Is an issue. It's something that we are told to put our personal baggage at the door when we walk in, do our job, and then go home.
Amy, thanks a lot for that call. Really appreciate it. Let's get back to our customer side of that, Tom. I've worked in retail a number of years. I never had a story quite as traumatic as Amy's, I'm happy to say, but there's definitely an element of people who I think don't really see that that server as a person really entitled to basic respect, hopefully not to the point of throwing pennies at them as Amy had happen. What do you think, Tom?
Well, I think that's an act of violence. I think to throw pennies at someone else, not to recognize that other person as being somebody's daughter, somebody's wife, somebody's mother. How dare that person act in that way because they were inconvenienced for maybe 5 minutes? And we see this all the time. Anger always needs a target, and those people that are less able to defend themselves. And how often you say, well, the customer is always right. Mm. And to see somebody sometimes take verbal violence and abuse because of that they're angry or upset about something and taking it out on somebody who has no way to defend themselves, that's just wrong. And need people. I've stepped in situations like that and said to other people, stop it.
Amy, thanks a lot for that call. Hope your job is going better than that day in the future. Tom Thibodeau is with us. He's from the Servant Leadership Program at Viterbo University. We are talking about the dignity of labor, whether people get respect for the jobs they do from employers, from customers, from society as a whole. How about you? Do you feel like you're treated as a person in your work? If not, what could make things better? Tell us about a job where you did or didn't feel like you got that kind of respect and dignity. If you're an employer, how do you look at this? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now about the dignity of labor and how employees, managers, and the public can build respect for people in all lines of work. Tom Thibodeau stays with us. He's an expert on servant leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about a job you've had, past or present, where you did or didn't get treated with respect. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Back to our callers now. Mick is on the line in Red Wing, Minnesota. Mick, hi.
Hey, how we doing?
Good. What do you think?
Good. Well, I just wanted to point out that I think we've done kind of a bad job of overselling the idea that everyone has to go to a four-year institution to kids these days. I know a lot of people in the trade industries that are looking for people to get into the trades and looking for more apprentices. And I think as a society, we've kind of looked at that field and not as high of a regard as people who get full four-year college educations or go into graduate programs. And I think that that might play into effect on whether people are, what kind of respect they're getting in their field.
Mick, thanks a lot for that call. And this is a long-running thing, Tom. Sometimes a lack of respect for people who work with their hands, who actually make stuff. I don't feel that because they're doing stuff that I can't do. But is there a general lack of respect there, do you think, Tom?
I think it's coming back. I think we understand things sometimes by their absence. And there's an intrinsic value in working with your hands. Think about this season, people are looking for things to buy that were handmade, homemade, local artists. People that are able to work with their hands have a sense of agency and competency, that they work on my behalf, and because they work on my behalf, they interact with me socially, so that when a plumber comes to my house and fixes something that needs to be fixed in my home, that's so that we have fresh water. Our lives are improved, and plumbers, electricians, people in the trades do this on a regular basis for all of us.
Mick, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Jason in Dodgeville. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jason?
Well, I was just it was interesting that I called them when they switched to the radio under my phone. I heard the lady had called them about the way people were treated by customers, mm-hmm. and I had called just to say that like yesterday on Christmas Day. At Quick Trip, I went in there and there were four people working, and I thanked all four of them individually for working on Christmas, you know, to serve me. And I've been doing that actually the last couple of years. I go to Walmart on Thanksgiving or anywhere else, and I, you know, whoever helps me or whatever kind of thing, I not only wish them the season's greetings, but also, you know, I thank them for being there for me.
Jason, thanks a lot for the call. And Tom, it sounds small, but does it make a difference, something as simple as thanking people for service they provide?
Yeah, what Jason did is really the best of our humanity. Hello, fellow human beings. Thank you for the work that you do on behalf of all of us today. I could not travel today if Quick Trip was not open providing gasoline and services. So all those people who worked on our behalf made our ability to experience leisure. Some of us have leisure because other people are working.
Jason, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Phil in Stevens Point. Phil, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I'd just like to call in and say I'm a natural resource professional, and I work with my hands all the time. A lot of people might look down and say it's dirty work, but it always feels good to, you know, work with your hands like your guest was saying, and to get compliments about the good work that you do.
Do you get those compliments, Phil? Do when you're doing the job, do people show appreciation?
When I have to spray herbicide, there's a lot of folks who are very against it, and they might call us names or say bad things. But I do get a lot of compliments, especially from landowners who are working on their land, about the good work that we do. Because like you're saying, it's something that they wouldn't be able to do by themselves.
Phil, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, your thoughts on what Phil had to say?
Well, what Phil had to say is that we see ourselves in our work. He sees himself as Phil sees himself as providing a service that other people need so that they can also make a living at what they do, and he's aiding in that. What happens is that we see ourselves in the work that we do. How often have you known somebody who was a carpenter who will drive you through a town and say, my grandfather built that house? And there's a sense of pride. This is what I've accomplished. What's difficult sometimes in where the work is shifting today is to see myself, my work. What is it that I've actually done today in front of my computer screen? How is it that people have responded to me in person rather than online? Where do I get that kind of feedback for the human work that I've done today?
Thanks a lot for the call, Phil. We're talking to Tom Thibodeau from Viterbo University, looking at the dignity of labor. Do we get respect in the jobs that we do, no matter what that job might be? You can join in at 800-642-1234. We go next to Jan with us in Burlington. Jan, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My comment is, Herb Kelleher, who started Southwest Airlines, had a philosophy, and that was, his front line were the most important employees. And if they had a customer who mistreated a frontline employee, you know, unjustifiably, they would fire that customer. And I think there should be more of that in this world.
Jan, thanks so much for that call. Yeah, somebody used the phrase, the customer is always right. I think that was you, Tom, actually, saying, well, the customer isn't always right.
Right.
That idea of an organization standing up for its people who are out there doing the work.
Yes, I think that for all of us, there's boundaries, so there's parameters, there's expected human behavior in the workplace that customers and guests of an organization need to respect, as well as people that are employed there. So that the respect is a moral responsibility of all of us.
Thanks a lot, Jan, for the call. Matt is with us now in Sparta. Matt, hi.
Hi. I'm a carpenter by trade. Been working on houses since, you know, I was 15 years old. Now, for a lot of people that work in that trade as carpenters, there's a certain ego that comes along with it. Now, I've never put myself in that spot where I thought I was better than anyone else. Have you ever waited tables? It's pretty hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty hard work. So, what I was thinking is, we are kind of all cogs in the wheel, but we can't all think of ourselves better than the other one, you know, if this wheel is going to keep turning.
But Matt, maybe not ego, but I'm guessing you maybe feel pride in what you do.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I've been able to, you know, drive my daughter past houses that I've helped build and, you know, be able to put my stamp on, you know, the planet, as you say. But, there's a little pride there.
Matt, thanks a lot for that call. Nothing wrong with that, is there, Tom? Pride, not ego, not I'm doing a better thing than other people, but I'm doing something important.
Well, exactly. And what Matt points out to us is that he's a craftsman. That there's the right way of being a carpenter, of creating something. And when he looks at a job well done, it's beautiful. So it's a work of art. Well, I would say that there's an art to serving people, to waiting tables. There's an art to being a nurse, to caring for people. There's an art to making sure that a hotel room is spotless and clean and inviting when a new guest comes. And so I think what people are seeing themselves, maybe not as cogs in the machine because it's kind of a mechanical way of human beings, but looking at ourselves as artists, that what is it that I'm doing is creating something beautiful for others. My grandmother was a beautician for many years and in Milwaukee, and her life's work was to make people's lives more beautiful.
We'll leave it there. That's a great place to end it. Tom, thank you, as always, for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so very much.
That's Tom Thibodeau, Distinguished Professor of Servant Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse. He joined us to talk about bringing back dignity and a sense of art to jobs and labor.